You're listening to the Inverse Podcast, where we explore how the scriptures can turn our world upside down,
or how it can be weaponized to uphold the status quo. I'm Drew Hart.
And I'm Jared McKenna, and this is Inverse.
Hello, everyone. We're waking up. This is Wednesday morning. We did not necessarily anticipate that we would have the outcome for the presidential election and the overall national elections so soon, but we do. We know now that Donald Trump has once again won the election and is going to be the next president of the United States. We did nonetheless believe that no matter what the outcome, that there was going to need to be a space for us to process where we are as a nation, where the church is in the midst of the nation that we live in, and the kind of ongoing witness that we need to embody and practice moving forward. And so we have this special episode. It's called After the Ballot, Deepening Discipleship and Democracy in Dangerous Times. And it seems really fitting for us to be having this kind of conversation right now. I know many of us are deeply discouraged, feeling the weights of what has come and trying to make sense of what this means, almost as a taking the temperature of our nation and taking the temperature of the church in the U.S. as well. Jared, real quick, I'd love to hear, you know, you're an outsider to this mess that's going on, but deeply connected and aware of all that's unfolding. What's your lens for kind of entering in and making sense of the outcome?
Yeah, thanks, Drew. I think Lisa and David, you'll both appreciate maybe two big influences for both of you, actually. So initially, the first thing that came to mind, which I read three times, I was telling Drew before we got on, is an article, an essay from 1946 that Howard Thurman wrote called The Fascist Masquerade. And the other thing I reached for, David, is your fellow Bonhoeffer scholar from South Africa, David Grouchy's book entitled The End Is Not Yet, Standing Firm in Apocalyptic Times. And I might refer to the book a little bit, but I actually wanted to read just this one sentence to frame, because I think it speaks to both the evolution of both your scholarship and your activism, both of you, and why I'm so keen that you were the two voices that we brought together at this time to have this conversation. Thurman, and again, this is in 1946, he says, "The bitter truth is that the church has permitted the various hate-inspired groups in our common life to establish squatter rights in the midst of believers because there has been no adequate teaching of the meaning of the faith in terms of human dignity and human worth." Mm. Human dignity and human worth.
That's right.
Yeah. The things that came up for me, Drew.
Yeah. Thank you, Jared. And so, as Jared already kind of hinted at, we've got two really important guests with us today. I want to give them their proper intro. So we have, neither of them are strangers to Inverse Podcast. We have Lisa Sharon Harper. She's the founder and president of Freedom Road, a groundbreaking consulting group that crafts experiences that bring common understanding and common commitments that lead to common action toward a more just world. Lisa is a public theologian whose writing, speaking, activism, and training has sparked and fed the fires of reformation in the church from Ferguson and Charlottesville to South Africa, Brazil, Australia, and Ireland. Lisa's book, Fortune, How Race Broke My Family and the World and How to Repair It All, was named one of the best books of 2022, and The Very Good Gospel was named 2016 Book of the Year by Inglewood Review of Books. The Huffington Post identified Lisa as one of 50 women religious leaders to celebrate on International Women's Day. Lisa is host of the Freedom Road podcast, co-host of the Ford podcast, and author of her weekly column on Substack, The Truth Is. We also have with us Reverend Dr. David Gushy. He is Distinguished University Professor of Christian Ethics at Mercy University, Chair of Christian Social Ethics at Vrije Universiteit Amsterdam, and he can help me correct my pronunciation. and Senior Research Fellow, International Baptist Theological Studies Center. He's also the elected past president of the American Academy of Religion and the Society of Christian Ethics. Dr. Gushee is the author and or editor of 29 books, including the bestsellers Kingdom Ethics and Changing Our Mind. His other most notable works are Defending Democracy from Its Christian Enemies, After Evangelicalism, and most recently, The Moral Teachings of Jesus. He lectures and consults globally and is widely regarded as one of the world's leading Christian moral thinkers. Gushee and his wife, Jeannie, live in Atlanta, Georgia, and you can learn more about him at his website, davidpgushee.com. Lisa and David, thank you for making the time to be a part of this conversation. We're really grateful to have you.
Thank you.
Thank you for the invitation.
As you both will know, Inverse is keen to ground our conversations in the scriptures in ways that can actually turn the world upside down or right side up. We'd love to hear from you both as people are seeking to process the news that you have woken up to and we've come home to at the end of our days on this side of the globe. What passages are kind of animating your imaginations at the moment, or what is alive for you that you're feeling drawn to in this very moment?
I had a phrase come to mind, and then I looked to figure the broader context in the scripture. The phrase was, "For they sow the wind and they shall reap the whirlwind."
Mm-hmm.
And so that turns out to be in Hosea chapter 8.
Mm.
And
wow,
this is what it actually says. It says like this: "Set the trumpet to your lips, one like a vulture is over the house of the Lord. Ooh. Because they have broken my covenant and transgressed my law. Mm. They cry to me, 'My God, we know you.' Israel has spurned the good. The enemy shall pursue him. They made kings, but not through me. They set up princes, but without my knowledge. With their silver and gold, they made idols for their own destruction.
Mm.
Your calf is rejected, O Samaria. My anger burns against them. How long will they be incapable of innocence? For it is from Israel. An artisan made it. It is not God. The calf of Samaria shall be broken to pieces. For they sow the wind, and they shall reap the whirlwind." I mean,
oof.
It's so early. I didn't know the results of the election until about like 2 hours ago, 3 hours ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just beginning to process, but sow the wind, reap the whirlwind. I would just say this to me, what that phrase and what this passage means is with full knowledge and massive amounts of information as to who they were choosing. 51 to 52% of the American people for the second time, with more vote than the first time,
mm-hmm.
chose Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And it was a nationwide victory. He got the popular vote. He got the Electoral College vote. It's coast to coast with exceptions here and there. It is, there is no way to say that the people who voted for him didn't have enough information about his character.
Yeah.
And so we are sowing the wind, and I fear that we and specific populations in particular, and then the world as a whole will reap the whirlwind in multiple areas. So that's my very depressing scriptural word that I have at this moment. For they sow the wind and they shall reap the whirlwind.
Wow.
Wow.
Well, I just looked again at Acts 8, and I actually think that Acts 7 was really what was most on my mind this morning. It's really the stoning of Stephen. Mm-hmm. And what brought that on. And then what we see is the dispersion, right? So I woke up this morning thinking about the persecution of the church, the dispersion of the church, but that all begins with the stoning of Stephen. Mm-hmm. And so as I'm looking at this passage in Acts 7 on the stoning of Stephen, I actually feel like I need to read a pretty long passage to
Take
you.
Take your time.
Because this is amazing, actually, what he says. I'm not going to read the whole thing because it really would be, we'd be here the whole time. But I will read a pretty long passage. It starts at chapter 7, verse 35. It was this Moses whom they rejected when they said, "Who made you a ruler and a judge, and whom God now sent as both ruler and liberator through the angel who appeared to him in the bush? He led them out, having performed wonders and signs in Egypt, at the Red Sea, and in the wilderness for 40 years. And this is the Moses who said to the Israelites, 'God will raise up a prophet for you from your own people, and he raised me up.' And he is the one who was in the congregation in the wilderness with the angel who spoke to him at Mount Sinai and with our ancestors. And he received living oracles to give to us. Our ancestors were unwilling to obey him. Instead, they pushed him aside, and in their hearts they turned back to Egypt, saying to Aaron, 'Make gods for us who will lead the way for us. As for this Moses who led us out from the land of Egypt, we do not know what has happened to him.' At this time, they made a calf, offered a sacrifice to the idol, and reveled in the works of their hands. But God turned away from them and handed them over to worship the host of heaven. As it is written in the book of the prophets, 'Did you offer to me slain victims and sacrifices? 40 years in the wilderness, O house of Israel? No, you took along the tent of Moloch and the star of your god, Raphan, and images that you made to worship. So I will remove you beyond Babylon. Our ancestors had the tent of testimony in the wilderness, as God directed when he spoke to Moses, ordering him to make it according to the pattern he had seen. Our ancestors in turn brought it in with Joshua when they dispossessed the nations that God drove out before our ancestors. And it was there until the time of David, who found favor with God and asked that he might find a dwelling place for the house of Jacob. But it was Solomon who built a house for him. Yet the Most High does not dwell in houses made with human hands, as the prophet says, 'Heaven is my throne, and the earth is my footstool. What kind of house will you build for me, says the Lord? Or what is the place of my rest? Did not my hand make all these things? You stiff-necked people, uncircumcised in heart and ears, you are forever opposing the Holy Spirit, just as your ancestors used to. Which of the prophets did your ancestors not persecute? They killed those who foretold the coming of the righteous one, and now you have become his betrayers and murderers. You are the ones that receive the law as ordained by angels, and yet you have not kept it.' And when they heard these things, they became enraged and ground their teeth at Stephen. But filled with the Holy Spirit, he gazed into heaven and saw the glory of God and Jesus standing at the right hand of God. 'Look,' he said, 'I see the heavens opened and the Son of Man standing at the right hand of God.' But they covered their ears, and with a loud shout, they rushed together against him. And then they dragged him out of the city and began to stone him. And the witnesses laid their coats at the feet of a young man named Saul. While they were stoning Stephen, he prayed, 'Lord Jesus, receive my spirit.' And then he knelt down and cried out in a loud voice, 'Lord, do not hold this sin against them.' And when he had said this, he died. And Saul approved of their killing him.
It's powerful. Yeah. I really appreciate both those texts and how they frame and give us just a really important lens for grounding ourselves in this particular moment. One of the things that I've really appreciated about both of you is in some ways, you know, as obviously both of you are discouraged in this moment, but you also have been living lives that have been witnessed and in some ways are ready for this moment, right? And so whether it's David's work around democracy, Lisa, your prophetic voice and activism, like you all have been faithful in, through the good and the bad, right? And so I'd really love to hear you all reflect a little bit on your own work, whether it's scholarship, activism, whatever you're working on, recent, over the past decades. But I'd love to hear how your lived faith and practices and work can help us navigate the aftermath of this particular election. I know, again, one thing that the Inverse community loves is trusted voices, and we trust and value your voice and your lived experiences as well, and how those two things come together. So, Lisa, you want to start off first and share a little bit about just how your own lived experience and work kind of brings insight into this moment and how you're navigating it.
Wow. What a question right now. I mean, I think for the last several months, I've been focused on the election. I mean, actually, I'm in a PhD program at the Free University, the one that we couldn't pronounce, which is understandable. It does stand for the Free University of Amsterdam. But I have to say and in fact, I just had a conversation with David, who is my supervisor, actually, in all full disclosure, that I really have been even shirking the PhD work in order to do this, because I just had a very clear sense that we have to leave it all on the field with this, because the stakes are existential. And they are now, the repercussions are existential. You know, two weeks ago on October 27th, I helped to organize, headed up an organizing effort here in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh that organized 2,000 people to get to the polls, the Souls to the Polls event. Drew, you and I were on a broadcast, actually just the week after, a couple days after that. I think it was actually a couple days before that. And it was really wonderful to be in conversation with thinkers and activists and theologians and pastors in the days before our election. But even going back before the election, I actually think the work that we had been doing for the years before that, a year and a half before that, with the Carter Center, is actually among the most important work we've ever done. And we encountered resistance, major resistance from the powers, you know, and it ended up folding because of that. But the work that we did with the Carter Center was to move 13 organizations, Christian evangelical organizations, through what turned out to be a year and a half process, supposed to be a 3-year process, but a year and a half process of truth telling and truth listening and truth seeking. And so we went on a total of 3 pilgrimages together, 2 per year. So one in this year. We were supposed to go on a second one in December, which will not happen. Second one this year. But the whole process was really for these evangelical organizations and institutions to do deep interrogation of the story they tell themselves about themselves and their own contributions to this moment. And in that group were some flagship evangelical institutions and others that were smaller and, like, you know, upstarts, you know, newer organizations, and as a result, much more nimble, so they were able to do it. So I think that my work over the last several years, and then of course before that, writing Fortune, which does that work of truth listening, truth seeking, and truth telling, not in that order, truth seeking, then truth listening, then truth telling, about my own family story. I just feel like that is actually, that is the work that is needed to heal us and move us into a different direction. But I think what we found in this election outcome is that more than 50% of our nation not only has not done the work, but rejects the work completely.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Thanks, Lisa. David.
I'm dealing with the reality of failure of of efforts that have been central to my sense of mission. And that itself is interesting to interrogate, in the sense, whoever promised success.
Yeah.
but let me describe failed missions. I wrote Defending Democracy from Its Christian Enemies in 2022 to basically locate Trump and Trumpism as an authoritarian political movement fueled by reactionary fervor against inclusive social changes, such as the civil rights movement and the women's movement and the gay rights movement, and a more multiracial society. And I was able to show, I think, that traditionalist Christians have been the engine of authoritarian and reactionary politics in multiple countries and multiple times.
Yeah.
It's usually the historic majority, racially, religiously, who feels threatened by any change in the status quo.
Yeah.
And so I went around for a year wherever I was invited, in church audiences and sometimes academic audiences, warning about, well, reminding people why democracy is fragile but worth preserving, and even how flawed has been, that it's still worth renewing rather than abandoning. And pleading with Christians to vote on the basis of not negative reaction to cultural changes, but defense of democracy and of a society in which everybody is included on equal terms. Now, it is important to note, I mean, national vote, 51-48.5%. It isn't like nobody believes that message, but not enough white Christians believe that message, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And I think the numbers are going to show, I mean, not only overwhelming white evangelicals, but also Catholics, white Catholics and mainliners as well. And so your quote, Jared, about hate-inspired groups getting squatters' rights within the church. Man, right on, Thurman. Wow.
Yeah.
So that mission, everywhere I went, I met warm responses, but that's from the dissenting part of the population now, I can see, not from the majority.
Yeah.
And then before that, and really the whole trajectory of a 30-year career has been about trying to help Christians follow Jesus faithfully, listen to Jesus' teachings, seek to practice them, resist cultural currents that are counter to Jesus's way. So whether it's Righteous Gentiles of the Holocaust, my first book 30 years ago, or Kingdom Ethics with Stassen, or the new book on the moral teachings of Jesus, Jesus's way is counter to this way that has just prevailed again in our country. But Jesus's way has always been counter to the illiberal, ungodly strands of our history, right? So there's nothing really new there. It helps people to, you might say, it helps to clarify that this thing called white American Christianity bears little resemblance to the way of Jesus and never really has. And mm-hmm. so if you're clear about that, then you don't have to be surprised about it. But mm-hmm. when one's mission has been to try to ask, especially white American Christians, to get their house in order, and to fail over and over again is very discouraging.
Yeah.
So I'm 62 and a half years old. I've been doing this since 93. So I don't know how much energy is left in me for a renewal of this effort, just to be honest. I'm getting old and I feel weary of the brick wall. I mean, already, you know about my work, that already exiled from the white evangelical community.
Yeah.
Now I look at the red wave across the country, and I look at my neighbors, and I saw somebody put it on Facebook today. Who was it? They were paraphrasing. Is it Toni Morrison? If somebody tells you who they are, believe them.
Believe them. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
And
Angela, sorry.
Is that Angela Davis?
No. Anyway.
if maybe one of our listeners would know where that
I know
is.
Why the Maya caged Angela? Bird sings. Maya Angelou.
Maya Angelou, yeah. Mm-hmm. So if somebody tells you who they are, believe them. If a country tells you who it is, believe them. And I live in Georgia. If you look every direction, it's red. We thought Georgia might be different this year. I'm in a sea of people telling us who they are.
Yeah, wow.
And so there's a turn in my work right now, anyway, towards biblical work again, towards church-based work, local work. And I think that's going to continue. There's a lot for everybody to do it in their own way. But anyway, that's really where my thinking has been going. But in honesty, the sense of I've sought to bear faithful witness, but it may be that as a white guy of a certain age, or trained in the liberal optimism of Glenn Stassen, liberal Christian Baptist, that I kind of thought that we might just win sometimes.
Yeah.
And I think the strength for resistance is going to come from voices that are used to not winning.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I appreciate that. And I appreciate what you both shared. And especially, you know, I feel like I've been quoting it just constantly, but like the Hebrew scriptures, they're many times talk about how the wicked prosper, right? And that's one of the, I feel like, the deep wisdoms that we don't always want to kind of grapple with. But certainly in this nation, Black and Native American people know more than anyone else, right? That the wicked do prosper. I really appreciate, I'm just thinking really quickly about what you both shared, Lisa, just the combination of this kind of grassroots work that you've been doing, electoral politics, seeing what's at stake, knowing that the stakes are high, and putting it all in. And at the same time, not getting stuck only in there, but recognize there's some broader truth telling that's got to happen, right? That can liberate us if we can dare to tell the truth. It can heal us in ways that I don't think we've kind of grappled with. And I think that's really powerful. And then David, also just the combination of you also trying to help people understand the significance of democracy, right? It's not perfect. Yeah. It's not God's kingdom, but it's the best thing we got. And it's actually much better than the alternatives that were being offered. And at the same time, not getting stuck, but also like inviting people into the way of Jesus Christ, right? And to hit that over and over again, how we can live and participate in the birth, life, teaching, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. And so I really feel like both of those things are really significant reminders for this moment. And even David, as you talk about, you know, as an older white man, what's your place in all of this? And how do we draw on the wisdom of those who understand, you know, was it M. Sean Copeland, you know, the wisdom of the crucified, right? How do we draw on that as we move forward as well? So, yeah, I really appreciate that.
I have a thought that I just want to share here. And I mean, I'm not a scholar of the Holocaust or the Shoah, World War II, but I've done a lot of thinking on it. And as one who studied human rights in particular and peace studies at Columbia, there was a moment when in one of my classes called Peace, when it occurred to me that the only people who were really positioned after World War II began, after Kristallnacht, the only people who were really positioned to stop the Holocaust were the Germans. Unless anything short of war.
Yeah.
The Jews were not positioned to stop it. They did resist, but they couldn't stop it.
Yeah.
The only thing that could have stopped it would have been for the Germans to lay down their arms and to resist from the inside. And some did, AKA Bonhoeffer and others, but not enough. And so what does that mean for us today? I mean, David, that thought was sparked by your really, you know, confession that I don't know if I have it in me to resist anymore. And it is true that the wisdom that needs to be followed at this point is those who have been resisting. But at the same time, this, what we are coming up against, what Donald Trump and Project 2025 has promised, is a militarized state. I mean, it's not just an ideological, you know, we're going to cut services for the poor and give it to the rich the way that, you know, traditional conservatives have done.
Right.
This really is basically at the Fourth Reich. Like, that's what we're talking about here. And it's militarized with nuclear power. And that means it's global. And so it just seems to me that, you know, yes, we need to follow the wisdom of people of color. But the reality on the ground is that the only people who will really be able to stop this, short of World War III, are white people.
That's good. That's good.
Yeah, I don't really think I feel free to retire from the field, but
thank you for that, by the way.
Yeah, feel.
But that's how I feel today.
Yeah.
And to be concrete about a couple of things, because Trump has a Republican Senate and because the Supreme Court is a 6-3 conservative majority and because of the immunity decision. Especially if the House also goes Republican, it's not clear what will happen there. And because he never cared much about guardrails anyway, and because of the people he will appoint in various
positions. That's right.
You know, the corruption will be rampant, but so, I mean, that can be taken for granted. The graft and the self-enrichment. But I mean, probably the most obvious first victim of state terror would be the undocumented immigrant, and in general, the immigrant population, given the problems of mass deportation and what would be involved in even attempting to do that. And so, in a sense, the people who would be best positioned to resist that at the national level would be people who would be the Senate or the judiciary.
Yeah.
That has already probably proven itself to be likely to be compliant.
Yes, mm-hmm. That's right.
You know, and so we don't know. Maybe overstepping would be resisted, but there's a lot of executive action power, especially on immigration stuff. So then it would be community by community, home by home, street by street, church by church, sanctuary stuff, and all of that, right?
Yeah.
So yes, there will be, I think, really frighteningly few legal policy guardrails. So, and dissenting voices like ours will not have much real power other than in organizing various kinds of grassroots resistance, I think.
I'm fascinated. Sorry, David.
No, go ahead. Yeah.
I'm fascinated. David, I've been reading you for a long time. When Kingdom Ethics came out, I had a copy in the first year. And for 16 years now, I've annually taught through the Sermon on the Mount at the different churches that I've served. And I am very aware that your vision, where you started initially, and even how you diagnosed possible sickness in our vision of discipleship and to some extent democracy, has shifted significantly. There's early Gushy where there was much more talk of maybe meeting in the middle, reconciliation, what's reasonable for both sides to come together. I would love to ask both of you, but maybe starting with David, around the evolution of your diagnosis. And David, you were hinting at, in terms of how that kind of modernist vision that all of us who are schooled in Martin King know well, in terms of the language of the eschaton and how it gets over-realized in such ways that might be initially mobilizing in some senses and in some settings, is completely discouraging given this kind of context. I would love to invite you, David, initially, and then Lisa, in terms of some of the progression in your initial diagnosis of things and where your analysis has led to a different practice. Would you invite us into that journey a little bit?
That's a great question. It involves getting in the weeds a little bit of my story, if that's okay.
We love the weeds.
I began my career, I mean, I did my PhD at Union, but my teaching career began at a very conservative Southern Baptist seminary, and then at Union University in West Tennessee, which was also pretty conservative. So red, white Southern Baptist world. I was really trying to invite white evangelicals to reform. And also there were white evangelical leaders like Jim Wallace and Tony Campolo and Ron Sider, who were like, hey, let's go that direction, not Jerry, you know, Jerry Falwell, James Dobson direction, that kind of conversation, right? Mm-hmm. And for a while there was some success there, though that whole project is over, that whole conversation is over, I think. I also realized, and Kingdom Ethics first edition 2003 was really mainly Glenn's vision. And I thought, I described it in the second edition after Glenn died. I look back at it as having a kind of a jaunty optimism. Mm. The kingdom of God is breaking in, and we get to be a part of it, and we can see signs of its good fruits, and we get in. And, you know, Glenn loved Dr. King and loved the whole arc of the universe bends towards justice. And so it was a modernist, though Jesus-oriented, eschatological hopefulness. Yeah. In the second edition, I the tone, Glenn was gone. I had the freedom to edit it to some extent more how I wanted. To say, you know, the kingdom faces just as many setbacks as victories. And I also was able to say, it turns out that church folks are often on the wrong side of the reign of God.
Yeah.
And so I was able to be more realistic about the failures of the church, about the church itself being part of the powers and principalities opposing the reign of
God. That's right.
You know, parts of the church, not all of the church. And about, you know, the costliness of kingdom work and the casualties. And so I think I like the second edition of Kingdom Ethics because I think it's already learned a lot. It's 2016. It's already learned from like the Obama years and the resistance of white evangelicals and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then after I got booted out of white evangelicalism, my sense of any hopefulness in that massive part of the American religious landscape evaporated.
Yeah.
And Meet Me in the Middle stuff became increasingly untenable. So anyway, I actually gave a sermon in Michigan at a post-evangelical church on Sunday in which I said, I used to think the main issue was polarization and the diagnosis is peacemaking and bridge building.
Mm.
And there's 42% of me that still wishes that's what this was about. but I now think the main issue is a tragic wrong turn on the part of white Christians in America, especially, that I have called authoritarian reactionary Christianity, can also just simply be called neo-fascist in some ways.
Yeah.
And in that sense, the bridge building becomes less important than the just saying no and resisting the evil that flows out of authoritarian reactionary Christianity. And I said, I think that's mainly where we are right now. So sweetness and light, bridge building, peacemaking, clean up a few things on the way to the eschaton has given way to a much more pessimistic, resistance-oriented vision, I would say. Mm-hmm. Do you see that in my work, Jared? Does that sound like what you see?
I see a picture of a cross that is located amongst those who are crucified, but is far more sensitive to those who are on the receiving end of ongoing crucifixions today.
Yeah.
I still hear a call to costly peacemaking, but the cost is much clearer that it was Daniel Berrigan put it, if you're going to follow Jesus, you better look good on wood.
Yeah.
That's the kind of strange, haunting call of a hope that will actually involve your whole life.
You know, there's a contrast I was taught. Luther talked about the contrast between a theology of glory and a theology of the cross.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the Theologia Gloria is like, divine triumph and God wins and all of that. But when you look to the cross, it's the Theologia Crucis, the theology of the cross. God ends up on a cross.
Mm.
People in the way of who are doing the way of Jesus stuff often end up on crosses too. And our theology has to make sense of that kind of world. So does our activism.
I really appreciate that. Thank you, David. Lisa, David mentioned Sojourners. When I first started writing for Sojourners in my early 20s, I was reading you all the time. You were already there. You were writing, and where you're writing started when I was reading you in the early 2000s and where it is now has shifted significantly. Would you give us a sense of how your diagnosis has shifted over that time?
Well, it's funny because I think that, you know, a lot of people call me the Shalom Lady. You know, I've been focused on understanding this biblical concept of shalom since 2003, mm-hmm. and have been writing on it, speaking on it every single, you know, sermon, talk, lecture that I've given has always come back to that or been grounded in that, because my own theology was so deeply transformed by this alternate understanding of the gospel, of what the good news of Jesus is. And I'm actually struck by what David really just said, which is, you know, this triumphal Jesus giving way to the Jesus of the cross. I mean, there's been a large part of me since gravitating to and pushing forward this vision of shalom that has embraced a triumphal Jesus, but it's not in this typical triumph that we would normally think of in terms of the purple robes and the military conqueror Jesus, but rather the Jesus who makes it possible to bridge the divides, who makes it possible for us to find God's kind of peace. And one thing that I am also just reminded of, even in this moment, is in chapter 2 of that book, The Very Good Gospel, we get into this vision of shalom and what is it, how is it grounded in Genesis, and looking at the sea monsters and the reality that, you know, everything begins with the deep and the darkness and chaos and destruction. And that's the beginning of the context. The context of the beginning is chaos and destruction. And what God does in the midst of that chaos is to create order, to create a boundary on the darkness. But the thing that really does strike me is that God doesn't eliminate the darkness. God doesn't eliminate the destruction. And somehow we are able to come to the high point of that epic Hebrew poem, and God says it's very good. And one of the things God is saying is very good is the reality that we are able to live in direct proximity to the things that we fear the most, the sea monsters. The sea monsters have not been eliminated. They're still there. And yet still God says, this is very good. And our relationship, even with the sea monsters, is very good. So there's something in that for me today that that wards off terror, knowing that, knowing that this text was written in the context of oppression and war and exile and chaos. And there's another part of me that is mourning the loss of where I felt like I was moving to. And maybe not lost, but maybe exponentially harder to go there, which is the ability to image the image of God, to rise full into the image of God for those of us who have had the image of God in us bludgeoned. And lynched and massacred and covered over and handcuffed and imprisoned. I thought, my spirit has been moving us into that. I have felt the spirit moving me into a time of examining what it looks like for us to really live there, to go there. And I've been thinking of it in the terms of Afrofuturism. Mm-hmm. And I've been thinking of it in the terms of post-coloniality, right? Like, what does it look like for us to live in a world that is after the colonization, where we all just get to rise full into the image of God in us. And yeah, without giving away my dissertation, which I don't want to do. But I do think that there is something for us. There's a lesson for us on the underside of oppression, for those who were still able to move into and find breath to move into the full image of God in themselves in the context of oppression.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. So in the context of terror, in the context, and that is our, like, people of color, LGBTQ people, women, basically everybody but white men, and actually even dissenting white men, right? That is going to be the struggle. How do we image the image of God in the midst of oppression?
Mm-hmm.
How do we live full into our dignity, our king and queenship, mm-hmm. in a world that is hell-bent?
That's right.
Hell-bent on not even, this is the thing, not even just like suppressing us, but annihilating us.
Yeah.
Like really, truly does not believe, does not want us to be living in the same space as them.
Yeah.
So in the words of Reggie Williams, who quoted another scholar who came up with this language, whose name I don't know, but another scholar calls it racism two. So there's racism one, and then there's racism two. Racism one says, you can live in proximity to us as long as you are submitted to us, as long as you understand your place among us, that you are inferior. Right. That is Jim Crow. Like that is what we kind of have, right? Like, but racism two is the racism of genocide. It's the racism of ethnic cleansing. It's the racism of mass deportations.
Yep.
It's the racism of annihilation and elimination. And that is what the Trump presidency administration represents. And so how do we image the image of God in that?
Mm-hmm.
That's my question.
Yeah, that's heavy. It makes, I've been, maybe sometimes I think about them in conversation. You talk about Afrofuturism. I've been reading a lot of Afropessimism, and Black studies, right? Mm-hmm. And the ways that they make very clear the ways in which Black social death is baked into modern society. And yet the one thing which it is, it's almost a, for me, I'm a theologian, so I think, and almost an ecclesial imagination of the possibility of fugitivity, of breaking out from a part of, even in the midst of living in a society that is bent towards one's destruction, right? That there is a way of being in the world that Black folk have been practicing for a very, very long time. Not just in the moments, the fugitivity is not just the moments of literal fleeing on the Underground Railroad, but as an entire way of life, constantly breaking, carving out space, right, for dignity and joy and thriving under constraints, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that is really powerful. So, but yeah, I really appreciate both of what you all shared, your witness, your lives. Honestly, as much as both you all have even in some ways brought more clarity to just the challenges that we face, but your witness and your lives also have been encouraging as well. I do feel that in my spirit, that hearing your all stories, y'all have been at this much longer than I have, right? And so just hearing your testimony and frustrations and stories have really been meaningful for me as I just think about what's next as well. And I'm sure, I'm confident that's the case for the rest of our listeners as well. So we really appreciate you making this time to just spend here with us and have these conversations.
Thank you, Drew.
David, in particular, I hope this doesn't feel like a kick in the guts, particularly today. And I'll be kind, I won't quote Dorothy Day. I think you can have a day to just not feel like continuing. But hearing you talk about how discouraged you are has been so encouraging for me. I really hope it would be wonderful if more, and I hope you hear this as a term of respect as well, more of our elders actually sharing the reality of how difficult it is to continue. And looking at how you both are processing this and inviting us into that with you, I draw so much encouragement from the faithfulness of what we deem as failures. And when you said right back at the start of the conversation, like whoever said we were supposed to be successful, the answer to that is America. Like, as an Australian, clearly name it, it's your culture. Like, our culture doesn't do it in the same way that your culture does. And I think some of that colors some of the vision of what it is to be faithful as well. So I hope you hear in me reflecting that back just how energizing you expressing your lack of energy is for the rest of us.
Wow.
That's very unexpected and very lovely and actually very encouraging to me this morning.
We're about to transition in a second because we want to respect your time. I know you all have busy days in a moment. So before we do, when we wrap, we hope if you can stay on just for a couple minutes, you might have a couple questions that people might want to ask. But again, we just want to thank you again for your time. I don't know if you have any parting last words, something you didn't get out that you just want to share before we close.
David.
No more words, not this minute. Nope.
Yeah, I feel the same. I don't have any words. I honestly feel like I need to listen. I need to be in the circle. Maybe these are my words. I need to be in the circle. I need to be in the circle.
That's good. That's so good. All right. Well, thank you all.
Thank you.
The Inverse Podcast is proudly supported by you, the listener. And if you want to join the revolutionaries who are helping us have conversations about how this ancient text can still turn the world upside down, why don't you head over to patreon.com/inverse.